Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that pits two movies with something in common in a fight to the death to see which one comes out victorious. This week in the red corner, if you go down to the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise, because there may or may not be the spirit of an ancient witch desperate to cause you harm, as three student filmmakers discover in 1999's The Blair Witch Project. While in the blue corner, there's no place like home, especially if your home has a resident demon with an unhealthy fascination for the less annoying member of a successful young couple. From 2007, it's Paranormal Activity.
This is my home, which I am leaving the comforts of for the weekend to explore the Blair Witch.
I can see you.
I'm real excited about this. Thank you for
I'm
the opportunity.
I'm very glad.
Sherry's been haunted by that old woman for years.
I don't know why you have to have every conversation on video.
Because we're making a documentary.
Not about us getting lost. We're making a documentary about a witch.
And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry. And cold. And hunted. Just want to apologize to Mike's mom and Josh's mom and my mom.
Can I get a little striptease?
No, boy.
I think we're gonna have a very interesting time capturing whatever is occurring or is not occurring.
The windows are locked, doors are locked, alarm is on.
Something's here. I feel it breathing on me.
So it's witch versus demon in today's fight to the death. Which film will be victorious? Let battle commence. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Butters.
I'm Chris Tilly.
I'm Alex, no Mike, it's not the same log, Zane. And joining us for this week's terrifying twosome, we have our very own terrifying twosome. Our very own terrifying twosome. Their insanely fun and wonderfully deranged own found footage horror movie, Dashcam, has just hit cinemas around the UK. A big welcome to Clashpod, to Dashcam writers and exec producers, Gemma Hurley and Jed Shepherd.
Yay!
Fantastic to have you here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's great. So first of all, congratulations on Dashcam.
Thanks.
Wow.
Thank you.
What a ride that movie is. So as we're recording this, we are still a couple of days out from when it hits cinemas, although when people are hearing this, it is out now. That's that confusion done. How excited are you to have audiences finally seen the movie?
Petrified.
Petrified, but also so excited, because obviously we had Host out in 2020, and because of lockdown, we couldn't see it in the cinemas immediately. It eventually did end up. So this is like a proper film now. It's like it's like a film being released in the cinemas, first off.
We could sneak into a cinema and see our audiences react.
I know,
that's
I'm doing
weird.
That every day.
But didn't it screen at the London Film Festival?
Yes.
And how did that go?
Oh, that was one of the best moments of my life. It was nuts.
It was at the Prince Charles Cinema, and genuinely people were running out to vomit. The guy who runs the PCC, Paul, he had to run out and because he was about to puke. And that's the best response you can get.
So the fact that you've made people fall sick, is that, does that make you feel good or
so
bad?
So proud.
Oh, it makes me feel glorious. Because the thing is that he also said that it was the most rowdy crowd since Evil Dead 2 in the 80s.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, what, it's an achievement.
What a compliment. That's great. So, I mean, we don't want to do too many spoilers because people are going to go see it, but what do you know what moment nearly made him sick?
Oh, well, there is a moment where every bodily fluid comes out. So I think it's probably that, perhaps.
Yeah, I had to take a moment after that scene. It's weird, isn't it? Because obviously Host was fantastic. But sort of serendipity-wise, like Host seemed like the perfect movie to watch during lockdown, because in the quiet dread of your own home locked down, that movie felt right. But this feels like a movie designed for a big crowd.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That was the thing. We were like, what do we do next? Like, you know, difficult second album. Like, how do we follow Host? Because we were, you know, none of us knew how well Host would be received. We thought, you know, maybe like a few hundred people on Shudder will see it. And, you know, whatever. We had like zero expectations. It was just fun. So we made this movie for like people in their homes, separated from their friends and like riffing off that anxiety and fear. With Dash Cam, like when Jed and Rob like said, hey, do you want to like do this other movie? Like we've been thinking.
Let's get the gang back together.
Like literally a month after Host came out, it was like, let's do a film that's kind of set in this sort of uneasy time where the world is starting to open up again, where we're not exactly safe. But, you know, get into the cinemas and like experience this thing we haven't been able to do for years. So that was the kind of idea behind it.
So if people haven't heard of Dash Cam, what is the setup?
So,
yeah, go on,
Jed, you take it.
Okay. Try and sum up that plot.
Oh my God.
Imagine a mushroom dream. So basically, it's about a woman named Annie Hardy, who is a kind of like a troll who does this live show from her car every day called Bound Car. And Annie actually does this, and I've been on that show. And what it is, it's a show where her followers suggest a word and then she'll rap it. She'll do a freestyle rap in her car as she's driving around LA. So it's about that. But then she comes to England to get away from the crazy stuff happening in America during the pandemic. And she gets involved in some supernatural stuff. Again, I don't want to spoil it. And it's difficult. But if you think of the last 10 minutes of Host, it's that, but for 70-odd minutes.
it's great. Was it exciting for you as filmmakers, as writers, having all these different tools for the first time? Because Host, you were restricted in what you could do. And now, to a certain degree, you have a blank canvas. Was that a big challenge or was that just pure excitement?
I mean, it was. I mean, basically, we wanted to just like, how far can we push this? What can we get away with? Like, because it was, we had all this like goodwill and trust from Host. It's like, people will be expecting we might do Host 2 or something in that same tone or something, you know, that's maybe just with a bigger budget because Host was so like limited. And then Blumhouse came along. We're like, yeah, let's do a movie. So it's like, shit, let's just like see what we can fucking do.
Yeah, that's it. Because like, obviously, like the about 3 days after Host came out, the Host 2 conversation started because everyone was talking about it. And I think on day one, I think Dread Central called it the scariest movie of the decade or something. And we were like, oh wow. And it didn't have a poster, it didn't have a trailer, it just dropped on a small streaming service at the time. So people were just like, what is going on? And then it just kind of went bigger and bigger and bigger. And then sure, we were still like in the kind of honeymoon period of it. We were just like, what is going on? So with the confidence that we got from Host, we were just like, okay, we can probably do anything right now. So me and Rob had a film that we pitched around pre-Host called Dash Cam, and no one wanted it because who were we? They didn't know who we were. So after Host came out and everyone started coming to us, we were just like, okay, we want to do this film, the film that everyone rejected. And it feels really good. Yeah, it feels really good. And just to do it with Blumhouse as well, who are obviously known for their high concept independent horrors, it's kind of a dream come true, really.
And that will be Blumhouse's most recent release. And obviously on Thursday, we're going to be talking about one of their very first releases.
That's true.
Oh, yes. I did love the quote. I read the quote for Dash Cam, a mic drop to the found footage genre.
Yes.
I think it's on the poster. What a great quote. Because it really does feel like a movie that goes, you think you've seen everything this genre can possibly offer you.
take a fucking look at this.
Yeah, exactly. I think at one point you do see the kitchen sink go past.
Oh my God.
All right. Well, I imagine we're going to be talking a lot more about both Host and Dashcam as we go through both our films this week. So the clue I gave you on last week's show was we're going to find something terrifying. Chris, follow that up on Twitter with...
I don't know. What did I do?
One of the films was shaky, the other was still.
Okay.
Got you back, buddy.
Love that.
Thank you.
Your guesses got lost in the woods on Twitter where we are at ClashPod, but the first correct guess to find its way out was Camillo. Congratulations to longtime listener Camillo. Your prize is nothing this week. You've been very naughty, so I'm going to need you to stand in the corner facing the wall. On Thursday, then, we're going to be setting up a camera in Chris's bedroom as he takes us through Paranormal Activity.
Nothing to see there.
Which means today I've got the map to the Blair Witch. Let me take you on a journey. Three student filmmakers, self-assured Heather, laid-back Josh and loose cannon Mike, go wandering into the woods to make a documentary about the legend of the Blair Witch. At which point, they promptly get lost. Mike gets scared and angry, so naturally kicks their only map into a river when no one's watching. They find some twigs. Josh disappears, leaving behind his teeth in a rag. Heather just won't stop filming. Mike stands in a corner. The end. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, The Blair Witch Project.
So when you put it like that, it doesn't sound like much, does it?
It really doesn't.
It reminds me of twigs.
When you pull it apart, you're like, why is this scary? Yeah, so our individual histories of this movie, I'll start the ball rolling. I know you've heard this story before, but this time it is fundamentally appropriate to the episode. Chris doesn't like it when I retell stories on the show.
I've not heard it, so please tell away.
So I saw this just after sort of the hype when it first came out, the Odeon Cinema on Parkway in Camden. It was a packed cinema, and we watched it, and the film plays out, and then it ends with Mike standing in the corner, and it fades to black, and then from the very middle of the room, this one voice goes, "What? That's it?" And the entire cinema cracked up, and any sense of lingering dread was gone in that moment. So I was a bit like, really? Yeah, maybe he's right, this jester. Maybe that was not that great. But then I watched it one more time a few years later on my own at home, and I've never been more scared. It's genuinely one of the most petrifying, actually, weirdly enough, and no smoke, but Host is up there with one of the most petrifying experience I've had. And there's a conversation to be had at some point over these two episodes about the circumstances in which you watch these movies and how that plays into your enjoyment of them. So, Jed, when did you first see Blair Witch Project?
So I actually didn't see it in the cinema. I saw it a little bit later, but I saw it on VHS, which I think is one of the best way to watch these types of movies. And again, I heard all the hype from it, so I knew what was to come. And obviously, I'm a massive horror fan. So when I first watched it, I think I was a little bit disappointed, like yourself at first, because I had the hype of this is the scariest movie ever. This made the most money. So I went into it with so much expectation, and then I was just like, oh, okay, that was good, but... And then it kind of sunk into my head, like, it's incredible what this film done. And when you research all the kind of the backstory and how they made it, it's just incredible. It just adds to, like, the legend of the Blair Witch. And I went, and since then, I've gone deep into the Blair Witch lore. I've read every single book about Blair Witch, every single thing. I have watched an unreleased making of the Blair Witch as well that I've got on my computer. No one else has got.
Wow.
I've got that. And recently, if anyone's seen my Instagram, I went to Burkittsville and I got to hang around in Burkittsville. I just turned up with my friend Blair and we knocked on doors. Legit, we knocked on doors, spoke to locals. We got the mayor of Burkittsville to kind of like hang around with us, and coincidentally, a bunch of the cast turned up.
Wow. And
so we got to hang around Burkittsville with a bunch of the cast. We went to all of the locations, the cemetery, recreated some scenes. We went into the woods where they filmed everything. I've got a bit of the Blair Witch house. And I don't know if you've seen recently as well, in the last few weeks on Twitter, the entire internet has said that they want me to remake the Blair Witch.
He's not lying.
And like the entire internet all at the same time. And famous directors and everyone involved with the original Blair Witch has come out and said, like Jed Shepherd for the Blair Witch. I'm like, where's this come from? It's insane.
I feel like you're making it happen.
Yeah.
Have you done some dodgy deal with the devil?
With the Blair Witch herself.
That's amazing. So is there, when you meet the people of Burkittsville, where so much of the film was shot, the legend, you know, it's the real life Blair.
Yeah.
Are they very much like, this is tourism for us?
I was told going in, don't speak to the locals about the Blair Witch because they hated it. But it was the exact opposite. Everyone was coming out of their houses, hugging us. They were so interested in telling us the stories of when they were there, when it was being filmed and stuff. And I know Eduardo Sanchez as well. So like he was emailing me and texting me tips of where to go and what spots to go to. It's so cool. And it's one of my favourite films of all time as well. So,
wow. Yeah. So is it eerie? Like when you go into the woods, like, because obviously in the film, it is, you feel it's terrifying when you're in the woods with these characters. But in reality, are the woods that scary? Or is it just like, no, there's a highway just there?
The woods are incredibly small. Like in the film, they just basically walk around in circles because if you walk for 5 minutes, you'll hit a road. That's it. That the creek that the map goes into is 10 seconds from the actual road with cars going past.
So it is the same log, basically.
Yeah, there's only one log there.
Definitely the same. Yeah. Oh, wow. Gemma, when did you first see The Blair Witch?
Oh, my gosh. Jed, you've got such a better story of this than me. So, like, the Blair Witch came out when I was, like, 10. So I saw it a few years later with a bunch of friends there was this girl who I was friends with who was obsessed with this film, like, to a kind of obsessional, unhealthy point. So we did this thing, like, British people might know this thing called Duke of Edinburgh Awards, where you go, like, hiking in the woods.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it would be a really, really, really good idea to like reenact the Blair Witch Project without telling anyone.
Wow.
We're on this. You two are the perfect team. Of course you write horror movies together.
We just watch the films. They live them.
To me, it was really funny. But like in retrospect, Jesus, like I made someone cry. I made like a twig thing and like put it up in the trees and put like rocks outside their tents.
Did anyone die?
They didn't know what was going on.
No, just me. I decided that this was going to happen. Like, and we did get lost. You know, I was meant to be the leader. So, like, you know, that's the thing I love about this film. Everything in it, it's like this could all just be not supernatural. And that's why I really like it. And that's why it frightens me, because it's like I could imagine that happening and just the way that human psychology gets when you're frightened and you're tired. And that's why it gets under my skin personally. So,
yeah. Chris.
So I didn't watch any horror when I was a kid because I was a scaredy cat. And then I watched every horror film when I was a teen. And then this summer, 1999, was the summer that cemented my love of the genre, because 1999 is this amazing year for film, for American indie, and the British film industry was doing good stuff. But it was the summer of Blair Witch and Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. Two most successful horror films of all time, pretty much, at that time. And both brilliant in such different ways. And so, yeah, I went and saw this on my own at the cinema. I couldn't understand what the fuss was about until the ending, and then it completely broke me, that ending, and it gave me nightmares. It's one of only two films to give me nightmares as a grown-up, and we might be talking about the other one on Thursday. Ooh, so that's my connection. But I tell you, when I knew that this one had properly crossed over was when my dad, who's not really interested in film, said to me, "Have you heard about this film? The people really die."
Oh, wow.
Love it.
All right. Well, we can go into that now. Now, a lot of my research about the backstory to this movie has come from the internet. I feel you may know more knowing Eduardo Sanchez having lived it.
Can I say where some of my research comes from?
Go for it.
It comes from a podcast called Jed Talks. It's a 90-minute interview with Eduardo Sanchez, and it's really good.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, we'll link to it from the Twitter, he's got a lot to say. He's got great stories.
Apparently, he said more on that podcast with me than he's ever said before about The Blair Witch. Like, there's stories in there about his depression following The Blair Witch that he's never mentioned before. So it's really interesting.
It's it's a good talk.
Okay, well, you might have to be our fact checker on this right now and go, that's not true. So let me start at the very beginning. 1993, Daniel Merrick and Eduardo Sanchez are film students, and they decide that they enjoy documentaries about the paranormal more than they enjoy actual traditional horror movies, and they come up with
this plan.
It was
one film that pissed them off. Do you remember what the film was?
The Legend of Boggy Creek.
No, it's Freddy's Dead. They watched Freddy's Dead and they wondered why scary movies weren't scary anymore. And having finished that movie, they sat down and said, let's do a scary one.
Interesting.
Which Nightmare on Elm Street is Freddy's Dead? Is that 4, 5, 6?
So Freddy's Dead is the one where at the end there's a 3D bit where all the worms come out. It's weird. It doesn't make any sense.
It's the so-called final nightmare. That didn't happen.
I got as far as four. I quite enjoyed four, but after that, I
Rennie Harlin did four.
That's
right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Is that the one with the veins where he's playing him like a puppet?
That's three. Okay. That's three. Yeah.
Alex, stop getting Nightmare on Elm Street wrong. Quickly, quickly. He's wearing a Nightmare on Elm Street t-shirt.
I'm wearing a Freddy t-shirt. Yeah.
What am I doing? So they come up with this mythology of the Blair Witch, which leans into the Salem witch trials, and they set it around the killings and disappearances of some residents of their town of Blair, Maryland, the fictional version of Burkittsville, Maryland. And these killings happened in both the 18th and 20th centuries. Residents blame these occurrences on the ghost of Ellie Kedwood, a Blair resident accused to practice in witchcraft in 1785 and sentenced to death by exposure. This is where it gets fun. So they create this mythology, and then they make an 8-minute documentary, because they need to get some money to make this movie. So they make an 8-minute documentary about three student filmmakers who disappeared while they were making their own documentary about the Blair Witch. And they tell these investors that these students actually did this. This is real. They have news articles that they've created and news footage they've made to back it up. And they say the tapes these students filmed are actually in existence. And the investors always say, so you've got the tapes? And they go, we'll have the tapes if you give us a little money. And by 1996, they've got some money together. They've got a 35-page screenplay, as they intend most of the dialogue to be improvised by the cast. Now, here's a question for you guys, obviously, because with a lot of found footage movies, there is a certain amount of improvisation, which I guess lends to the authenticity of the thing. So how does that work for you when you are writing these films?
Yeah, exactly that. We ripped off the Blair Witch Project. We genuinely did. And that was our plan from the start, in terms of the template of how to make it. The Blair Witch, they have what's called a scriptment, which is half script, half treatment. Mostly bullet points. Do this, do this, do this. Get to this place. What happens in the middle is kind of up to you. But it's that improvisation that the cast bring to it that makes it feel real and authentic. And that's essentially what we did for Host and Dashcam. You have to have a little bit of realness in order to convince people that they're potentially at threat and this can really happen.
So the casting process must be quite important in the films that you guys make, because you have to find people who are capable of doing that on the fly, which isn't a skill that every actor necessarily brings to the table. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're really lucky with Host. Genuinely, they're all our friends. Mm-hmm. So we have this WhatsApp group called the Quarantine Movie Club, and everyone who's in that Quarantine Movie Club WhatsApp chat is in Host. That's it. The producer, Rob, the director, me and Gemma, all of the cast, they're our friends. And they were our friends. We made loads of shorts together as well. So we just stuck them all together in this film. And luckily, because they have that relationship with each other's friendship, you can see on screen, it feels real, because it is.
And with the amount of improvisation they were doing in Blair Witch, Eduardo was worried that in the heat of the horror, they were going to say an actor's name rather than a character's name. So that's why he uses the actor's names for the characters. Is that the same for Host?
I imagine. I think that was, we just wanted to make it seem as authentic as possible. And I think that's probably why.
We again ripped off Blair Witch Project. Yeah. you can see in that interview I did with Eduardo Sanchez, he was asking me, why did you do this? How did you do this? I can't believe you did this. And I was just like, Eduardo, we copied the Blair Witch. That's how we did it.
But with the name thing, Paranormal Activity does the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a through line with all these fan footage, the ones that work.
Yeah.
For us, it was mainly like the responsibility, just give them a framework that they can build trust in, that they had, you know, they knew what their relationship dynamic was, where the conflict was coming on, and really just like give them something, you know, a track to go down so they could have that freedom. So it didn't just, you know, so it didn't just spiral and kind of go nowhere.
Yeah.
But so they could actually have some fun within the parameters we set, basically. Yeah.
So our three, they were as immersed, let's say, in this by the directors as the investors were, in the sense that each of the cast members got a full-colour brochure that had all the festivals of the fictional Blair County as though it was real. Mm. And they included a zucchini festival. There was a smiling girl holding up an armful of zucchinis, how Heather Donahue remembers this brochure. So this is a full immersion experiment, I guess, the filmmakers are doing. So we've got Heather Donahue cast alongside Joshua Leonard and Michael Williams as Mike. Joshua Leonard is the only one who's still acting professionally. Mike is an acting teacher and guidance counsellor. Heather left acting in 2008 to become a medicinal marijuana grower.
Oh. Yeah, with that Blair Witch money. But I've seen, you know, there's 40 hours of Blair Witch material. And in this documentary that I've seen, they were given cameras from their journey to Burkittsville from like New York. So I've seen footage of them like on this coach to go to Maryland, basically, and they're filming themselves in character. So I've seen all this, almost like a prequel to The Blair Witch, them actually arriving there, and they still pretend that they know each other and stuff. And it's insane.
That is kind of insane because, yeah. I mean, if you've got all this footage, you sort of wonder why they've never sort of gone, well, we could actually do the prequel to this movie. I mean,
they could
40 hours of footage cut down into what, an 85 minute movie?
Yeah. And do you know, in that 40 hours of footage, you actually see the Blair Witch as well?
No way.
Yeah. You do.
What? Yeah. What? When she turns and goes, what the fuck is that? In the woods.
Yeah. You see the Blair Witch in it. Yeah.
Oh.
And
I haven't seen all of the 40 hours. I've seen like a cut down version, but I've kind of seen the making, what the Blair Witch was going to look like.
Is she like dressed in white? I think I read something.
No, she's It's all black and...
Oh, like black, the black furry animal thing.
It's quite witchy. Okay. It's quite... Yeah.
what do you expect?
Well, yeah. we can talk about what Heather is actually screaming at, because there is a real thing there in the woods, which is quite funny when you hear what she's seen, and also terrifying. But by 1997, they're in the woods of Maryland filming the actors. They film everything themselves. They got notes on what they were supposed to do at various checkpoints that they found with GPS, along with batteries for the equipment and ever-decreasing amounts of food. So apparently this whole thing came from producer Greg Hale, who had done some basic military training where enemy soldiers would hunt a trainee through the wild terrain for a few days, and they applied the same technique to the cast. This is an actual quote from the directors. If we physically and mentally abuse them enough in the process of getting them up to those intense moments at the end, then they'd be able to tap into emotional places that they wouldn't otherwise. We deprived them of sleep. We made them move a lot during the day. Then at the end, we slowly fed them less and less, and they never knew what was happening. They were always off balance. They do say, we would never jeopardize their health or anything like that, but we broke every SAG rule possible.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, he said on your podcast that the SAG overtime rules would bankrupt them now as well.
Oh yeah, but like when you see them in this making of documentary, I mean they were up for it. It's not like they were like terrorized.
They've never complained about the experience. Yeah.
But the money helps.
So we've talked about this a bit lately, haven't we? Like last week, talk about E.T. Like, is it better or worse than making a child cry on purpose to be in your movie?
That's true. That's a good point. Mm. Yeah, Spielberg did it.
Evil.
This is very Hitchcock territory, really. Isn't
oh yes, yeah. Yeah, it is.
He only does it to blonde girls though, so
he does it to well, that's the thing with when people do it to just women actors. Mm. It's just like, oh, but you can't get the performance without it. I'm like, oh, but they're actors,
like, yeah.
Trust them, like it's a bit better.
It's their job.
I had that exact question written down, like I don't know if you're an actor and it's like, just let me act. Yeah. I can do terrified.
You don't need
it's
to
like
torture me.
We don't trust you enough, so we're going to scare the shit out of you.
That's exactly in these improvised, semi-improvised films. The actors do sometimes say that they'd rather act. They'd rather act rather than the director trying to put them into a place where they are more susceptible to like scares and stuff. But you just have to trust your actors, really. Yeah.
Well, the Sanchez and Merrick call it method filmmaking. So it has a name. It has a name. So they get the film made from all these 40 hours of footage. They spent 8 months editing, take it to Sundance, where it becomes a surprise hit and the first movie to sell at that year's festival for just over $1 million. And what I love is even at the festival, they're still doing this sort of guerrilla, this is real marketing, handing out leaflets to people who watch the film, asking for information on the missing students and if they could contact them if they find out anything about them.
And a bootleg of it got out of Sundance and was being passed around Hollywood, and they were pissed off about it. They thought this was totally working against what they were trying to achieve. And then, of course, it actually played in to what this is, because when they started making the film, they kind of wanted people to discover it as an unlabeled VHS and just put it on. And so that was what was almost happening within Hollywood, which sort of built up the myth.
So very quickly, just before we get into the movie proper, we should touch on this incredible marketing campaign. This is the first time the internet was successfully used to market a film. This is the first film that went viral on the internet before that was even a thing. Their website basically just played this as real. falsified police reports and various other newsreels about what was going on. The IMDb page in the first year of the film's release listed the actors as missing, presumed dead.
Jesus.
So they went all out. Do you remember how you felt about this? Because I remember at the time going, I'm pretty sure I was like, well, it is obviously not real. But I think there was a part of me that wanted to believe it was real so much because I knew that would increase my enjoyment of the film, buying into this myth that they were creating.
Well, it clearly had my dad concerned.
I'm just flabbergasted at the balls of those guys. Like, again, they barely had any money to start with, but they just had this concept to kind of make it happen. And I think every other film has tried to do this in to some degree now. Even with Host, I don't even remember, Gemma, but we kind of posited the idea that maybe the Coast cast would stay off socials for like a week afterwards or something.
Yeah. But like, that did not happen.
They're like, no, we're going to promote ourselves. But no, it's incredible. And it's never been repeated, really.
But it can go wrong. Diodato, who made Cannibal Holocaust, he did a similar thing around that film. And I think he ended up in court.
He did.
On the murder charges, because his actors were off travelling for a year to stay low profile. And he got prosecuted for their deaths.
He had to bring in the actress who was on that pole. Look, she's alive. She's right there.
Well, for me, I think, yes, most apart from your dad, maybe, most of us watched that film and were like, yeah, okay, they're not really missing. But there's that element of doubt, and that's all you need. It's just that, like, but what if, you know? Like, I think that's how it succeeds, rather than, like, necessarily being convinced that, you know, people have actually been murdered by a witch in the woods.
I think we're all, like, semi-interested in the thought of a real snuff movie, because none of us have actually, I think, seen an actual snuff movie. But just the thought of it, it's kind of dangerous, and that's kind of how it felt.
Yeah, and enough to have that suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
That's what we're after.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you watch a movie about snuff movies called 8mm and you go, actually, it's really boring. Who knew snuff movies could be boring? Right, we're going to take a short break and then we're going to go through this movie.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Right then, let's journey through the Blair Witch Project. We'll start with section one, Meet the Three. I think it's so incredibly efficient how this film sets up our three main characters and the relationships of them in the most minimal dialogue. For example, when Josh arrives, Heather says, oh, look, it's Mr. Punctuality. And in that one line, you were establishing a long friendship, a relationship, enough knowledge about each other. So you're like, bing, they're friends.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then you find out that she made that line up on the spot because he was always late. And you're like, oh, wow. That's like a happy coincidence.
Yeah.
And we get there. And then, of course, Mike is the new person in the group. So we already have this interesting dynamic. Heather's in charge. Mm-hmm. Mike's sort of the reluctant new guy, just wants to do this job. He's not really invested in it. And she wants to present the footage, which is a kind of nice joke. She wants it to be as real as possible. No cheese. The woods are scary enough. So what do you make of these characters and how they're introduced? Because the film doesn't really go to any great lengths to make us like them. It wants them to be real people.
I think that's it's such an interesting question because rewatching it recently, it reminded me of how little we actually know about them and their lives before this movie starts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite, for us, when we were doing Host, we had a similar thing. Like, how much does the audience have to know and like and care about these people before you like send them off packing to see the spookies? And for Blair Witch, yeah, as you said, like all you need to do is kind of get the sense of the dynamic. And that's really enough. And I thought it was so brave and efficient to be able to do that. But you just get it. And that's all we have. And it's, yeah.
Yeah. And like, again, I keep referring to this making-of documentary that nobody's seen. I'm sorry, but
this is the one that you are the only person in the whole world.
It could be making. Really no. Why has it not come out? Is there stuff on it they don't want out, or is there just rights issues? Or what?
It's rights issues with Artisan, but I think it was shown at a couple of festivals a few years ago. But basically, in this documentary, which is called The Woods, it has the casting process. So you see the other people in those three roles, like interacting with each other, and how they kind of picked them, and they were quite obviously the best. But like you could see some of the other threesomes and what it could have been. It could have been so different. But I think the people that they picked are just so natural and are so comfortable. And you have to be good at improvisation as well and quick on your feet because you need to be able to react to what's around you and not panic and go out of character. But yeah, I think out of all of these, Heather is a real find. It's a shame she's not acting anymore because Heather's incredible.
Yeah, she's incredible. I agree. But we were also at the start of this form of storytelling. We had the real world on MTV, sort of reality TV was just starting off. The Office was just around the corner. And so it was quite new to see people who felt real. And that authenticity, I think not only from them, but from the townspeople that they meet is what makes this feel real.
Agreed. And again, it's about trusting your audience as well. I mean, you know, you don't need to spoon feed them. I mean, like Dashcam, for example, it starts straight away. You know, you are aware that enough people are aware of what streaming is right now, of how that show would work. You don't need to labour the point. It's just like, yeah, we get it. Let's get into this.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
So section two, legend building. We are quite literally bamboozled with information at the start of this movie. There's the original legend of the witch Ellie Kedward tried for witchcraft. There's the 1940s child murderer, Rustin Parr, who made one kid stand in the corner while murdering the other. There's the remains found at Coffin Rock, which I don't know which legend they're attached to. I think it's really clever. because it's meant to be confusing, because it throws so much at you that it knows you can't retain it all. So as the audience, you are as confused as the characters about what on earth is actually happening, who the villain is, it's the ambiguity that makes this film so scary.
And the key piece of information comes from a young guy who you don't really trust. He's some dude,
yeah,
and he's the one that tells the story about the basement. Yeah. And that's obviously the most important bit of information for the ending of the movie, and that's something that the first time I watched it, I just set to one side. No, it's this other stuff, the coffin rock thing, or the hermit, or the witch. This is the important stuff, but it was that bit, but they just sort of chucked it away and trusted that you would remember it at the end. It would flash up in your brain.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point, Alex, about just the amount of information they throw at you, because it is overwhelming, and it kind of like just puts question marks in your head, like, what's been going on in this place that so many weird supernatural things have happened in this one place? And having gone to Coffin Rock and seen it for real, and it's just a place where kids go to smoke weed now. It's just so interesting. And if you dive into the books and to the other material that surrounds the Blair Witch, you find out loads more about these various different legends and how big this world is that they've created. It's unlike any other film that I've ever seen. For such a small film, the amount of mythology around it is enormous.
But how much did they actually create? And was it just people cashing in, the film company cashing in after the fact? Like, were Eduardo and Daniel involved in those spin-offs? Or?
Yes, to certain degrees. But I think when they interview people in the street, they've woven in some of those stories. And obviously people know that alongside The Blair Witch came a Discovery Channel documentary called The Curse of the Blair Witch, which was a little bit more information to world build. And there were like things like, there was like a computer game or an online thing. There's loads of videos on the website as well about Rustin Parr. They were very much into the world building straight away. But one of the most interesting things that came out is around the time of the Blair Witch was Heather Donahue's diaries, which was like an online thing. I don't know if you guys seen that, in those diaries, she knew full well that something might happen in the forest. She knew about the Blair Witch. So when she says in the film that it's her fault, it genuinely is her fault, because she's brought these other two people into the forest knowing full well that stuff's going to kick off.
I'm so pleased you mentioned that, Jed, because we can get into this. I'm going to touch on them, and these aren't my theories. These are theories that have done the rounds on the internet. Some of them are good, some of them not so good, but we'll talk about them as we come to them. But you're right, that bit with the kid who talks about the children in the cellar facing in the corner, I think I'm right in saying that was added in later, because the original ending was even more ambiguous in so much as he was in the corner, but there was never any mention of that earlier. Yeah. So after the film was finished and bought by Artisan, they put that back.
I'm glad they did that. That would mean nothing to me if they hadn't done that.
Yeah.
And how about this one moment? Because there's a mixture of actors who are planted in the town, who the filmmakers come across, the students come across, but they didn't know they were actors, as well as genuine townspeople.
Yeah.
That woman they meet who's got the kid, and when she starts talking about, she's holding a baby and she's like, so yeah, this is what happened at Coffin Rock. And the kid just goes, no.
Yeah.
Complete accident.
Amazing.
I mean, what a gift that is.
So I don't know if you guys seen online, but I hung out with that mother and daughter.
What?
And I carried the daughter, like she's like in her 20s now. I took a picture with that daughter, like putting her hand
she's
over
going,
my
no,
face.
Jess.
She's also saying no, because I just lifted her up. But they couldn't be more pleased as to tell us about their experience at.
But what's the story there then? Because it really does feel like that kid knows something.
Does she remember?
She doesn't remember, no.
But her mother in that, was she just made it all up on the spot? You know how, I do think it is an American thing. Like some Americans like just sort of go, yeah, all right, okay, cool, yeah. And they just like, will just sort of reel off, yeah, I know about that, yeah, the Blair Witch, yeah. And they just start talking and she just made all that up on the spot.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of pointed her in a certain direction and then she riffed off it. But like, it's gold finding those characters, real life characters. And the fisherman as well at Coffin Rock, he's such a character.
One quick theory number one: the townsfolk done it. There's a theory online that the townsfolk are responsible for perpetuating this Blair Witch myth for money, because of the tourism it brings in, and so that's why they're all so eager to help the kids at the start, because they want to build this myth and scare the kids, and then the footage will perpetuate the myth of the Blair Witch and they'll make more money. But they did kill them in the woods.
The townsfolk killed them in the woods to keep it going.
Yeah.
Or like specifically the fishermen.
Possibly, yeah.
I love that
fisherman.
Theory. That's really interesting.
We can't not mention Mary Brown as well, played by Patricia Decoux. She applied to be an intern on the film, and they obviously put her in as Mary Brown. They shot that Talking Heads moment at her house. The gate being made of the same twigs as the twig men later was completely by chance that her gate was made like that. Theory number two, Mary Brown killed them.
That's more realistic because she's kind of witchy in the first place. And I think, again, it's just solid gold that they came across this woman who fits into this story so well. And just the way she talks is quite sinister. I could believe that.
It'd be too obvious, though, wouldn't it?
It would. I think it's a bit...
We've set this woman up as a witch and she's the witch.
But I think what's nice here is it leans into that that horror movie trope of these kids are really dismissive of her because they she's a lunatic. She thinks she's great. All of this, that classic thing of like, uh-oh, don't start diminishing the locals.
Yep.
That never ends well. So section three, into the woods we go. Our trio set off. And like you said, the very last people they meet, the last humans they meet before they go into the woods are the two fishermen who kind of act as that like last gas station attendant in horror movies. Yeah. You know, I think one of them even goes, "Fool kids never learn."
Yeah, I met him. He said that.
No way!
And he said that to me as we left as well. No joke, he did. It's so cool.
That's amazing.
That would scare the shit out of me because I wouldn't know. Is he doing it because he knows I like it, or is he genuinely like, "Here we go again"?
Yeah, they're back. No, he was really nice. He makes clocks and stuff in Burkittsville. He's a real like handyman and. Yeah, he's incredible.
Can I ask you a question, Jed?
Yeah.
Primed with all of these people trying to spook you.
Yeah.
Did you get spooked? I know you don't believe in ghosts. I know, but was there a moment where you were like, actually, I feel a little bit uneasy, like out there?
Well, there were trees in Burkittsville that did have the Blair Witch kind of course, men in it, but obviously that's kind of for tourism.
Did you camp overnight in the woods?
We stayed in an Airbnb nearby. Okay. But I wanted to stay in the woods, but I just thought no, because
some Airbnbs are scarier.
It's true. It's true.
In the woods. So again, I love what the fishermen say. It's this, like I said, this ambiguity. They describe her as a white mist rising out of the water. So we've really no idea what the witch may look like, if she indeed exists at all. Right then, funnily enough, considering how the woods are so small, apparently the actors did manage to get lost by accident on day one of the shoot.
Wow.
Daniel Merrick says, "I figured at that time we were boned. They just got lost off the road. We were screwed."
Wow.
So they find seven piles of rocks. Scary, this? Is this scary at this point, the seven piles of rocks, or are we still warming up?
We're warming. Doesn't he knocks over one, though, so that's a bit of a...
ominous.
Has he done the... You know, there's always a thing that the characters do in horror movies that where they deserve what their fate.
It's the transgression.
Break a rule. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever you do, don't knock over that pile of rocks. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I know. So this is... I don't think it's Heather's fault, anything that happens. I know you're like, yes, it's Heather, but for me, it's just like... I don't know. She respected those rocks, so that's what
interesting. But I think this is just like general kind of folk horror kind of stuff. It's very ambiguous as to kind of the mythology. It's kind of a question mark. So at this point, I don't think there's anything to read into it. I can't remember if
Are there seven? I can't remember. I should have checked.
Seven dead kids.
Then there's don't want to jump ahead.
Yeah. No, it's fine. No, that's good. You're absolutely right. So seven rocks, seven dead kids, and then later
three piles of rocks. The three of them outside. Ten. Mm-hmm. So it's like
not clocked that. So by kicking over one of the rocks, he's kicking over one of the dead kids.
Is it
kids.
Like a warning like trap or something? Like, oh, there's someone in the woods, let's go murder them.
Well, then surely that seventh dead kid should come after them.
Maybe it does, because the witch doesn't kill people herself. She gets other people to kill them for
that's
her.
True. That's
so
true.
There we go.
Yeah, yeah. She possessed Rustin Parr and he killed the kids.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
Oh, God, that standing in the corner stuff, that gets under my skin. Yeah. So, section four, there's something out there. They get terrorized in the night by some sounds, which are great because they're indistinguishable. You don't know what they are. And this ambiguity, I keep saying it, but it's like you can't make out exactly what these noises are. And we get a nice Deliverance reference. Obviously, they're clinging on to the logic at the moment. There's just some townsfolk messing with them.
Yeah.
Just messing with them. And this is where the group first starts to fracture. So Heather pretends to know where they are a lot. Mike doesn't believe her. He's angry. Even laid back Josh starting to get slightly annoyed. I watched this and I think I would be annoyed with Heather as well.
Yes.
I think she's fantastic in the movie, but I do think that constant, like, I know where we're going. And yeah. You're like, I don't think you do.
She's
like,
denial. No.
Exactly. Yeah.
But watching it this time, I wondered if Heather does know where she's going and there's something happening in the forest that's disorienting her. Mm. She's doing the right thing, but there's something out of her control that's happening with the compass and with them. They could be going the right direction, but whatever's happening is sending them in the wrong direction each time, and that's why they go in that circle without realising for all that time. So I was wondering if maybe it isn't her fault. Like, I'm on your side here. Maybe
agree.
It isn't her fault.
Because doesn't she have, like, a book in her backpack that she brings with her? Like, she's clearly, like, where it's about, like, survival, how to survive in the woods. Yeah. Like, she's done her research. Mm. She's not an idiot. You know, you think she... So maybe I'd like to think that it's the woods messing with them, or maybe just even psychologically, like, that something's going on.
I don't know. I've got theories about Heather.
Okay.
They're running to the other Blair Witch films as well.
Right. Okay, good. Because yeah. I was going to say, now I haven't seen the 2016 sequel/reversion. Now, apparently in that, it does lean into the idea that the witch can, like, mess with time and space. And so I guess that then leans into the idea. There is one theory, I'll do it now because it's crazy, that the witch has transported them back to 1940 and they are actually no longer in the present day. And it is Rustin Parr who is still there doing his murders.
That's interesting. I didn't know that theory. Yeah, it makes sense because when you watch a 2016 film, there is like time loops and time shifts and stuff. So that would kind of make sense.
Okay, well, sure. We'll do more theories as we go on. More scary noises in the night. Someone suggests it could be deer. It's not deer. apparently, when they put those three piles of rocks, because the whole thing, as I said at the start, is like the filmmakers trying not to interfere. They wanted to leave the cast on their own.
Yeah.
Apparently, the code word was taco. which meant stop, don't come out of the tent because we've woken you up putting rocks outside. Yeah. We want you to discover them in the morning.
Hold on, they didn't have much food. They were hungry and they're shouting taco at them.
Yeah.
Piss off.
So this is where annoyance builds into mistrust in the group because Heather loses the map and Mike genuinely seems to believe she's saying that because she wants to stay out there. She doesn't want to go home. She wants to get as much footage as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. The bit where Heather keeps saying, like, you do feel, I think you've been in that situation. We've all been in a situation where something weird has happened and you refuse to believe that it's happened. And she's going, you've got the map, guys. I know, stop messing with you. Yeah. And the panic, like buried in her voice when she really wants one of them to go, yeah, we got the map.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great.
So you only like that bit because it's exactly what you would do is hide the map for a bit longer than it's actually funny. Yeah.
Like, Chris, honestly, I really don't have the map. Like, it's gone. We're screwed.
That's just your thing.
Well, let's do section five. Why would you do that? To be honest, I had forgotten this since the last time I watched it. This is just the oddest sort of plot development in the whole thing where Mike, who is desperate to get home, has kicked the map into the creek the day before because he says it's useless.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
So there's several theories here, isn't there? Like, one, is the Blair Witch already in his head? Is it, you know, is she making him act strangely? Has he, you know, does he say that, you know, is not true? Does he just say that because he's just so pissed off and like, whatever, like, let's stop looking for the map and things like that. Let's move on. Or has something happened, you know, in a kind of Raymere's survival way? Have they actually all gone a little bit off their nutter? Like, you know, because that happens when you're exhausted and you're angry and they're
lack
not
of
thinking.
Water, lack of food.
Yeah, like, you know, I like to read it like this is a survival film gone wrong kind of thing, and like everything makes sense apart from maybe like the blood. But like, so, or is Heather, you know, potentially doing what I did to my mates, and is she like, and she wants to, like, you know, make a like a meta film, and she's doing all this? I'm not sure.
I think that's the only point in the Blair Witch where I'm just like, okay, that's a little bit sus. That genuinely wouldn't happen. There's no real reason for him to like kick it into the creek
because it goes against his character.
Yes,
so far
100%.
He's the one who is so desperate to get back, and it's an interesting one because, as we said at the start, the filmmakers, basically left instructions, individual instructions for the actors. So they have an individual packet that they'd open, and I think I'm right in saying it would tell them individually what their motivation was, what the big thing that they did that day. And their mics was, you are the one who has lost the map. You've got rid of the map. Do with that what you will. And he then improvises, I kicked it into the creek. So he came up with that on the spot. And when you start to hear that, you go, well, there really is no rhyme and reason. He was just improvising it. And it doesn't fit into a bigger picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. But it almost, because it's so bizarre and left field, it feels real because real life isn't exactly like A to B.
And
so
would the map have saved them?
No.
Or they'd be on the point of no return. They're sort of in the wilderness now. They're in the Blair Witch's world. So I don't even know if the map matters. I do think it's interesting the line that came before where Heather says, it's very hard to get lost in America these days and it's even harder to stay lost. And I think this is sort of a glimpse at this ego and their hubris that's ultimately going to be their downfall a little bit as well by thinking they can mess with whatever this is.
Well, the genius thing about this film is in that first title card, it tells you they're not going to make it out of these woods.
Yeah.
So you know something bad's going to happen. Mm. So that's the genius of this film. They tell you the ending at the start and you're just like, you're waiting for it to happen, which is why the tension builds and builds and builds.
And where's it going to come from? Is it going to be the misty person? Is it the furry person?
Furry woman. Yeah. You want to hear my... This is my favourite theory. This is one of the most popular theories.
Okay.
And I tend to lean into this. It's that Josh and Mike... have lured Heather into the woods to kill her. Wow. And they are members of some cult. And this has all been part of their plan all along to murder Heather and get away with it by having this orchestrated footage and this ambiguous footage. And the evidence for this theory points to the fact that Mike and Josh are often walking ahead separately to Heather. Wow. They are the ones who get rid of the map. At one point, Heather says, "You're having too much fun for my liking." And they are sort of laughing and joking at one point while she's more nervous. Mike, this is where it starts to get a little bit shaky. Mike, as the sound technician, could create the cackling in the wood at night. And finally, Heather wisely insists that they walk in a single direction to find their way back to civilization. But Mike and Josh are the ones who overrule her.
Mm. That's right. And they lead her to the house at the end.
Yep.
And you don't see either of them die.
Nope.
Well, this is why I've got a problem with it being Heather's fault. Because, she was like, I really want to make this film. Like, forget about, like, what we know about things that happened after the movie and what's been written. Yeah. Like, taking the movie as it is.
Which I think we have to.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, she just wants to make a film. She doesn't really believe any of these things as far as we know at this point, you know.
I think she does. I think she does believe in the Blair Witch and that it's... I think she knows that something supernatural going on.
Yeah, but she's not expecting to go into the woods and like potentially die and her hubris, her flaw is that like just stop shooting takes, you know, safety properly. But she does this thing where she really apologizes, and there's something that doesn't happen in the film that we're going to talk about in a minute where the perpetrator does never apologizes, but she does. I don't know if she's really responsible for like all, you know, she didn't kick the map into the thing, as far as we know. She doesn't go to the woods. Like, I mean, it's the guys who lose their shit.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't. Like
her crimes are being curious and keeping the camera in her hand.
And also, I forgave her a lot when, because I'd forgotten the line, because it's almost an incidental line where she explains why she's filming constantly because it makes everything unreal. So by watching it through the camera, she doesn't feel like she's in such a terrifying situation. Mm. And I really get that. And that makes me go, that makes a lot of sense for, you know, why you are, you know.
I forgot that line as well. That's so interesting, especially in the 2016 film, that comes into play again, like that particular theory.
She's watching the world through a filter, which is how a lot of people seem to be living their lives these days as well. It feels like it's quite prescient in that way, where if it's not on your Instagram or your TikTok or whatever, it's not really happening.
Yeah.
Survival technique for sure. But it helps her. It helps her like to keep her cool where everyone else is literally like screaming and shrieking and getting angry. She's just, I think she's the calmest.
Well,
when they
discover the stick people and shortly after that, it's an effective moment where Mike is just shouting into nothing, help her! was!
And she's saying, please, I've just got to get this on 16.
Yeah. Like,
she does, but to be fair, she does, you know, the question is always, why don't you just put the camera down in found footage film? But I feel like they do justify it well enough most of the way through this in a way that it didn't bother me.
They don't know they're going to die. They think they're going to get out of it. So like, in the back of her head, Heather's like, won't this be amazing when we get out of here and we'll have this footage? And
this is going to play at Fright Fest.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Gemma knows like that the hardest thing in the world is finding excuses for your characters to still be holding the camera in found footage films. So like that's why is Annie still got her camera on when like a demon's chasing her?
Works with Annie, doesn't it? Because she's kind of nuts anyway. Yeah. So she is the kind of person that would go, fuck, I'm going to film a demon.
Yeah, it really is. But in Host, we thought of ways as well. But yeah, in the Blair Witch Project, it's because it's their school project and she's very studious. She wants to get a good grade and she feels like if she sees this through films everything, then she'll get a good grade.
Another line she says a bit later is, I want to go home, but I just want to get what we can.
Yeah. Mm.
Is this film about the creative process slowly killing you?
Wow.
As two people who've,
The interesting thing is, does she die at the end, though? Mm. Because I don't think she does.
Oh, we've got... So we can talk about this, because I think you're leaning into one particular theory.
Okay.
Well, first of all, we'll do section six. Oh, my God, what the fuck is that?
Best line of the film.
Scariest night yet, though. They hear children's voices outside the tent. The guy who plays Mike Williams, says this was his most terrifying moment during filming. They obviously, again, didn't know it was going to happen. The directors put speakers around the tent and played. It was Eduardo's neighbours. They recorded his neighbours' kids reading, playing, talking gibberish. They played it outside the tent. No one knew what was going to happen. And, yeah, it's scary. They run off screaming.
What does she see, Alex? I need to know this.
So she sees art director Ricardo Moreno dressed in white long johns with white pantyhose pulled over his head running alongside them in the woods.
That's amazing. Right, yeah.
That would scare the shit out of me. Can you imagine? If you don't think you're going to see anyone, you've never seen anyone for the shoot, and suddenly you're running, and then there's this thing, like a white blob, running alongside you.
Pantaloons.
And you also had, at the same time, the filmmakers all dressed in kind of camouflage as well, in the trees as well, like banging things and shaking trees at the same time.
She sells it.
She does.
That's my favourite scene in the entire film, I think.
Oh, yeah?
Really? I could just imagine it happening to me. That's the type of shit that would happen.
What? Blair Witch will come for you.
A man in white long johns with white pantyhose pulled over his head is following you through the woods.
I've done a lot of camping. Shit happens.
Well, because that's interesting, actually, because this I've done some camping as well, and the bit, like, I'm sure it's most people who've been camping, one of their fears is the idea, hearing something outside your tent is one thing, but it's when something pushes the actual canvas and there is actually a physical thing outside, and this happens at this point in the movie, something presses against the tent, which is when they run out screaming.
That's the thing, because it's just like you're in this cocoon, it's just like this millimetre thick canvas, but like there's a part of you, the child in you, it's just like, if it can't see me, I'm safe.
Yeah.
But then there's that also aspect of like Jesus Christ. Like when they run out, like you're in there. I'm like literally in the tent with them. And you can just imagine like, what would I do in that situation? Would you like stay in the tent? Would you run? And that's why it like, I think it's so effective because you're there, you're all thinking that.
It's one of those childhood things where if you think there's a monster in your room, you put your duvet over your head, and as long as you don't poke your feet out or like look, you'll be safe.
Yeah.
Because you do, you feel like, well, I'm in my property. So no one would invade my property. This is my little house.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, but at the same time, you are like, it's like there's nothing between you and anything dangerous outside.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've been camping where there have been animals outside, or what I thought might have been Blair Witch, I don't know, in retrospect. But like, I've been camping where like my fire has come back on mysteriously. And then it's always like, was that because I didn't put it out properly or someone's trying to lure me outside? Like your mind goes to places when you're like away from every other human because it's like every noise, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Big camper, Chris, do you ever go camping?
I like a bit of camping.
You like a bit of camping?
Yeah.
Ever get scared?
Prefer a hotel.
Yeah. They got to a point where I used to like camp at festivals a lot and then I was just like, not anymore. Yeah. I'll just find a hotel or an Airbnb nearby.
Yeah. I'd say campsites, particularly Reading Festival, is one of the scariest places I've I've ever been. And you're surrounded by people, and that's why it's scary, because they're people who are at Reading Festival.
The Sunday at Reading is like a war zone. I remember the last time I camped out Reading on a Sunday, a bag of human feces was flung at my tent, and it just went all up the side. I was like, oh, thanks.
What?
Just human shit down one side of my tent.
I'm like, but that's okay. Good tip for festival camping. Do camp near the toilet.
Never camp near the toilets. Jesus. When you go to Glastonbury and you see people who've pitched their tents near the portal,
oh,
those
on the first day,
what are you thinking? Do you know how this works?
Yeah.
You are literally sleeping in shit for the next two nights.
It becomes a river of shit that goes towards you and your food and your friends.
But you're right. Sunday at Reading. So I think it was the year Metallica headlined. So literally... Yeah. All the Metallica fans, they were headlining on Sunday and they got down there to the front. From the moment they opened, they just stood there. And every band that came on that wasn't Metallica, they hated. And I remember Good Charlotte came on.
I remember that year.
People were randomly throwing the odd bottle of piss, because everyone comes armed to Reading with a bottle of piss. And they were throwing the odd bottle of piss. And then Good Charlotte, they sort of had enough. They were like, look, if you think you're going to be able to hit us, why don't you all throw at once? Oh. I'll count to three. In my head, they'd basically gone, they don't have many left. He went one, two, three. It was like the start of Gladiator. The number of bottles of piss that took to the air in one moment and headed for the stage was just immense. And all the band were hiding behind the drum
kit.
It.
Oh. It happened to Daphne and Celeste
as
well.
Celeste. Yeah.
Daphne and Celeste.
Yeah, poor girls.
Yeah, the Rasmus. I think the Rasmus cut their set short because someone threw a firework on stage, actually dangerous. 50 Cent did about 15 minutes. And then he literally did as long as he had to get paid. And in the middle of a song, he just stopped and walked off. He was like, I've been paid now, I'm going. So, Reading Festival. Great days. Section 7. He slimed me. This is where things get really weird. All Josh's stuff is covered in slime. And it's after this final night that Josh finally snaps. Quite effective when Josh snaps, because he has been sort of the voice of reason to a certain extent. And when he screams at Heather, it feels very real. Theory number, I forget now, let's call it 6. Josh at this point is possessed by either Rustin Parr or the Blair Witch, and that's why he's lost his mind.
He is surprisingly cruel there, and it's tough to watch. Again, we're justifying why she's got the camera. She says, it's all I fucking have left, okay? It's a tough scene to watch.
It is.
they're blooming good actors, aren't they?
They are. In this film. And apparently, and again, I haven't seen the 40 hours of the rest of the footage, but a lot of it is arguing between Josh and Heather.
Well, before that moment.
Throughout the entire thing, it's just arguments.
Because I do wonder, that was one of the things I wanted to know more about, was like, what was their dynamic? Because the power dynamic between them before this film happened, I wanted to know a little bit more about, are they just like that usually?
Well, I think there's a thing in especially in fan footage movies, like the actors, because they're given a lot of space, they want to deliver, so that maybe they try to create conflict in order to please the director, whereas maybe being a little bit more subtle, it works better because it's more realistic. I don't know.
I think mostly when you're acting in sort of your traditional film, you are required to act for however long that scene takes, and then you go back to your trailer or wherever, the canteen, and then you're back on. Here, you are on 24/7. As long as you are filming, you are on, and you cannot keep up a performance for that long. So that's where it starts to break down. And reality, especially when your filmmakers are starving you, that you get these very real performances, because people are at their wit's end at this point and they can't perform. They're being very real. So on the night Josh disappears, Josh, as far as Mike and Heather were concerned, genuinely vanished in the night. He waited for them to fall asleep. He was told to wait for them to fall asleep, snuck out of the tent, and they woke up to find him missing.
Oh my gosh.
And that was that.
So cool. That is so cool.
I'd be so freaked out.
Because do you think that, because they also had a code word to stop it, so if it was Taco.
Taco!
Do you think they did that because, I mean, there's a possibility that in the night, you're in the middle of the woods, that someone could come and kill you, just a random.
Did they begin to have that possibility in the back of their head that something's going wrong?
Wow.
I think he would.
Eduardo said in an interview with you that in the original script, it's Mike that disappears.
Yes.
Ooh. But over the course of this shoot, they shifted it to Josh.
Do you know why?
No, he didn't elaborate. And I
I think it's the dynamic. He wanted to keep the dynamic, the most interesting dynamic together, maybe, potentially.
But yeah. in Host...
Because they don't know each other. Because yeah. Mike's the new one and Heather doesn't know him. At least she'd have a handle on Josh, whereas she's left with the guy who's been freaking out a lot from the start.
Did you try to keep the order that your actors would get killed in Host from them, or did they know from the word go?
Oh, I don't know if I should be saying this, but like the entire time we were shooting it... I guess we didn't really know what order they were going to die in, because we could have put it in any order, but I had Emma texting me every 5 minutes, Jed, don't make me die first. Whatever you do, don't make me die first. And genuinely, in the writing process, she was like, Jed, whatever you do, don't make me die first. If you notice in Host, she has about four times where she could die, because we keep moving the goalpost. We go, okay, so Emma dies towards the end. But then we realise Emma is so emotive when she's like scared. It's good to keep her in it, because she's the kind of the eyes of the audience. Mm. She plays the audience. So keeping her in it for a little bit longer meant the film was better.
And I was just watching an interview with Ken Loach yesterday, and that's what he does in his films when characters have been killed in his films. He likes the actors to react on set rather than prepare to react for it. And so the actors around the person who's being killed don't know, and the person themselves, Cillian Murphy, was saying when it shakes the barley and then previous stuff he's done.
Well, that's true in Host, where the other actors didn't know how each other were going to die. Yes. That was kept a secret from each other. That was redacted in the script.
Yeah, and then we're witnessing it, as we were witnessing it, Emma didn't know Teddy would be set on fire, basically. So her reaction, screaming, seeing her friend being set on fire, she didn't know that was going to happen. So her fear is real fear.
So you guys are doing it as well. You're just as bad as this lot.
You are.
Yeah, but they got a hot meal after each taking Host. That was the.
I mean, they had to make it themselves, but
yeah, they had to.
Yeah, it's in their houses.
Bless them. So when when Heather finds the twigs with Josh's teeth in, some real teeth that they borrowed from Eduardo's dentist. I say borrowed. I'm not sure if he wanted them back. When she finds that initially, she picked it up and just chucked it away. And the film had to be stopped. That was one of the few moments where they came in and went, no, you have to open it. Really good. It's kind of a good moment, because she just sort of went, moved on.
I checked Wikipedia there, because it's hard to make out exactly what is in that bundle. Yeah. Wikipedia claims tooth, finger, hair and tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? I didn't catch all that. But
again, I think it's the ambiguity.
No, it's great.
A fleshy mass.
You would have just seen it quick in the cinema. Even if you pause it now at home on Blu-ray, like I did, you cannot see it. It's just this bloody congealed mess.
Yeah, it's just a reaction that makes you horrified. But just with the stick figures, again in this documentary that no one's seen but me, there's one bit where the art director, he's just fiddling about with twigs. And I think it's Eduardo Sanchez that goes to him, what are you doing there? And he's like, I'm just putting this like thing together. He's like, oh, that kind of looks cool. And it's the twig man. Like it was just something that the art director just decided to do, like on the spot.
Yeah, because none of the people in the town, I mean, maybe I'm misremembering, but none of them mention the twigs, do they? Yeah.
No.
Was something I was like, well, this isn't even in the mythology. So how does,
Yeah, but then in a 2016 film, they kind of retroactively put it into the mythology that it means something,
So... it's time for your Heather theory, Jed, because we're going to section 8.
Okay.
The confession.
Yeah.
So, as you touched on earlier, when she's sort of saying it's all my fault, and sort of taking the blame. Initially, you're like, okay, she's taking the blame for them getting lost in the woods, but there could be more to this than that, what she's actually taking the blame for. And you mentioned her diaries, her journals, which were on the website, and there were lines in that, for example, she writes in these journal pages, which you can find, I can't explain the kinship I feel to her, talking about the Blair Witch. I cannot see how she could avoid perceiving the energy I am sending her way and have been for 2 years now.
Yeah.
But if they want us to be worried about that, that should be in the film, if they want us to be thinking about that, I think.
That's retconning it, isn't it?
Well...
I think these pages were released as part of the promotion.
Right. Yeah. Sure, but it's not in the film. I think if it's extraneous information, I don't think we should read into it too much if we're analysing the film.
But then...
what's their intention? Yeah.
Yeah, and again, if you treat... I don't treat Blair Witch 2 as canon, really, but 2016 film, I do. And again, spoilers for the Blair Witch 2016, if anyone is interested. But I believe... at the end, I'm sorry, Alex, like you haven't seen it, but I believe
that's fine. Go for it.
At the end, there's what you think is the Blair Witch coming after the lead, and the whole thing is about the brother of Heather going to Burkittsville to find his sister, because he's seen a video of her sister in the woods. And I believe that what you think is the Blair Witch isn't the Blair Witch. It's Heather. Heather has been, she's been changed by her time inside that house, and she has become this kind of creature. Mm. And maybe it's the kind of, she's possessed by the Blair Witch, but everyone thinks it's the Blair Witch, but I believe it's Heather. And I think Heather is reaching her her final form. It's what she wanted from the start. She wanted to be part of this mythology. She was so into it, but more than anyone else. And she maybe needed these sacrifices along the way in order to become this person. And the stick figures, that's kind of what she looks like at the end of the film.
Oh my God.
It's creepy.
I hope someone's listening to this in the dark. In their own, yeah. The way you just told that story was petrifying.
Yeah, and also, the only way that she can't kill you is if you look through a camera lens. So like, it's interesting. As long as you stand in the corner and you look through the viewfinder of the camera, you can see her coming behind you, but she can't get you unless you look at her.
A basilisk kind of thing. Ooh,
so what's
like
she apologising for here then? Because isn't she getting what she wants?
I think she's apologising just because it's almost inevitable that she has to have... the mythology is quite ambiguous, but I think she needs, and every person that this witch or this evil entity has possessed has had to kill a bunch of people in order to, I don't know, either satisfy something deeper and darker. Because again, in the mythology, it's like the land that's evil. It's like something inherent in the land that possesses these people to do something. So
maybe it's the last vestiges of Heather's sort of moral human self, like sort of clinging on to the fact that she has some inherent guilt in killing Josh, in killing Mike, and what she's going to have done because she believes in this mythology. And this is the last glimpse we sort of get of her, like her moral, like compass going, I'm sorry for what I've done to the families, but fuck yes, I'm the Blair Witch.
Exactly.
But if I'm watching this scene and I'm not thinking that Heather, what's about to come in the 2016 film, and that Heather's wants this and is responsible for this, I think it's an incredibly moving scene.
Yeah.
And it's what makes this movie, I think, knowing that you're watching someone about to die.
Yeah.
They know they're about to die. You know they're about to die. And it's just incredibly moving.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, totally.
Yeah. It's like it should be a redemption moment, but alas, you know, you still, they can't be saved. Yeah. But this is, so, I mean, just going back to this theory, like, I appreciate that. Maybe that's true. I don't know what Awadu
says. Oh, I don't know if it's true. Well, I don't know if it's true or not. Like,
but I still think that all of these theories, like, can have an element of truth in them. Like, there's not just one fit all theory. Like, I think, you know, there is a version where all of the actors making this film kind of, went a bit loopy in the woods. Yes, they were tired, but there's also this sort of almost subconscious thing where you're sort of leaning into it. Like maybe one of them, whether it's Heather or Josh, and I think it would probably be Heather because she's the one who really wants to make this film, might be doing what I did to my friends when we're in the wood and might be like leaving, like, you know, trying to freak out everybody, try and get these, like, maybe she made the Blair Witch Project, but it all kind of just went out of control for her. And no one actually necessarily dies at the end, but they've made this film that's going to...
That's a good point, because ultimately this is her project.
She wants
to make it interesting, right?
Yeah, so I there's a part where she might have set off like, okay, I'm going to do this. But then you can't anticipate how people are going to react and it all spirals out. That's my theory.
That's great.
You don't need a witch, but it's the craziness that happens, and you feed off energy, and like we're aware of these things that happen, like mass hysteria. Mm-hmm. It's like a documented thing.
Yeah.
That's my theory on this film.
So wherever Heather is, if she didn't die at the end, she knows that her student film got picked up at Sundance and got a international release. So she's got to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the great thing is, because she's left acting, it just adds to the mythology, doesn't it? Like, maybe this is real. Where is Heather? I haven't seen her in anything.
So it's our final section. Section 9, somebody put baby in the corner. We have the running round Rustin Parr's home. Now, again, at the start, I'm pretty sure they said it got burnt to the ground, which would imply that this house shouldn't be there, which again leans into this time travel. They've been transported back to the 1940s, where Rustin Parr's cabin is still there and he is actually the murderer. It's not the Blair Witch. It's just a loony guy who claims, as he does at the start, that when he returns to town, he was possessed by the Blair Witch. We get a bit of running around, handprints on the wall.
Oh, their little hands, aren't they? Little children's hands. Oh.
And then the terrifying last scene of Mike standing in the corner. The end or as a bloke in Camden put it, what, that's it. So this ending, so after Artisan bought the film at Sundance, they requested an alternate ending because test screenings apparently left audiences confused with the ambiguity. Now, obviously, in the end, they put that bit in earlier where they talk about the kids in the corner and that ties to Mike being in the corner. But they did film three alternatives.
Yes.
You're aware of these, obviously.
I've seen them all. Yeah.
And? Well, take us through them, which you like.
So the one they went with is definitely the best because it plays into the mythology and makes the film ultimately really scary. But there's one ending that I really like where Heather goes down, she hears the noises of screaming and stuff in the basement. She goes down there and Mike isn't in the corner. He's hanging on some kind of like stick thing. Like he's become the stick man and he's hanging in the middle of the room. And I was like, wow, that is terrifying. Like what is going on there? I'm trying to remember the other ones.
It's where I think he's facing her. So there's something really confrontational and a bit like, oh, it's aggressive. So you go down, he's just like, you've been screaming for him. And then he's like on silent and then he's just standing there watching
staring
you.
Yeah. And it's like, is Mike in on this or is he a victim? Like,
which makes it with that version, it's like, oh yeah, the boys are in on it and they're like screaming with her for sure. But like, that's they definitely chose the right one.
Yeah.
There's one where he was hanged as well. I think that's the third one. But again, I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is the shot that stays with you. Just that crazy. I think because it's so weird. Just having a man standing in the corner.
The uncanny.
Yeah.
It's true.
I mean, look, I can, within the confines of this film, I'm happy if anyone wants to stand in a corner. I'm not sort of walking into rooms going, does no one go in the corner? So, any more, or shall we do the bits?
Yeah, just what I got off your podcast again, when Eduardo was talking to you, he said that they wanted to make a prequel. It was a Rustin Parr story set in the 1940s, and they wanted to shoot it in black and white. That was their plan.
Ooh.
But obviously, the studio wanted a movie out within 9 months, a sequel, and that's how we got Book of Shadows.
Yeah, and actually what I edited out of the podcast is his idea for a sequel for Blair Witch.
Mm. At his request, he didn't want it out there because he might make it.
Well, I think I was played into it a little bit, but no, well, like cards on the table, I actually pitched to the studio a new version of Blair Witch about a year ago. They were looking for takes and I pitched my thing and I showed it to Eduardo first and he was like, yeah, this is basically what I was going to do because it's based on the mythology, looking into it a little bit more. And
was that the script that he wrote in 2010? Because he does mention that. He said it was called Burkittsville.
Yeah, yes.
His version, his was going to be different accounts of what happened in the woods.
Yeah.
I guess that night.
Yeah. And one thing that he wanted to do was really delve into the mythology more, like the Rustin Parr story, but also Ellie Kedward and even further back, like what happened even further back. Like it's the land that's evil. Something's wrong with the land.
It's all there, isn't it? You've set up so much mythology that just hasn't been used that it's just sad. Like they haven't really had the opportunity to, I mean, obviously I don't know if they would work together again, but certainly Eduardo regrets, I think, not having done another Blair Witch when other people have got to do it.
The things he said about Blair Witch 2, just him and Daniel sitting in the cinema watching Blair Witch 2 going, what is going on here? What is this?
And that's like a year later.
It's exactly a year later.
I don't know the story of where this happened. Sorry, I'm on the back.
So obviously they wanted to rush out another, because Blair Witch made Infinity money, they wanted to do it, but they weren't ready to do another film just then. So they got another filmmaker to make it and it's not found footage. It's not great at all.
Right.
There were some interesting ideas, but it's not great. And I don't even think of it as canon.
No.
Okay.
Whereas I like the 2016 one.
I like it too. Yeah. Actually, me and Rob Savage, we're a little bit obsessed with the 2016 one, more than we should be, just because there are some real interesting things they did there for the mythology. The thing they did wrong in the 2016 version is they showed violence and death on screen, which the original didn't do. Mm. And that's why it stays in your head. It's like a psychological horror rather than like gore.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Differing accounts of what happened in the woods with the townsfolk of Burkittsville.
Yeah.
That'd be good. Right then, let's pick our bits from this movie. I'm going to start with you, Chris. What is the best scene from the Blair Witch Project?
I'm very glad I wasn't in that cinema with you, Alex, because it's the final scene for me. And I don't know if it would have been ruined if someone shouted out something like that and everyone laughed.
Yeah.
It might have made me laugh, but it frightened me then and it gives me chills thinking about it now, and it's what gave me nightmares. So for me, it's the final shot.
Well, I'll quickly second that. Yeah, Mike in the corner. I'm not actually always a big fan of ambiguous endings, but I think because of the rich mythology that the filmmakers created, and I've actually, I know you say it's not in the movie, but I've enjoyed so much like digging outside the film because I think it actually makes the whole film experience just more engrossing, like having all these different things that it could, it might not be. So I like the fact that the ending leans into that and allows you to like look at all these different theories as we have done on the show and sort of go, oh, it could be that, it could be that. By not going, it's definitely one thing or the other, you can have fun with it. Jed?
I think my favourite bit is the exact opposite of your bit. It's the title card at the start, just with the disclaimer, essentially, just telling you what's going to happen in the film. Because I just think that's genius. Mm. It really plays with our expectations. And I mean, I'm sure it's happened loads of times before, but just it's so iconic. I have that on three different T-shirts, that text. So I absolutely love that. And it's been copied so many times, but the ending and the very start are just so iconic.
Yeah, I think it's Fargo was the obvious one that did it before that. Okay. But yeah, then obviously we then had like a Cloverfield that everyone started doing.
Yeah.
Gemma, what is your best scene?
I've already said, my one is the one in the tent.
Yep.
Because I could just imagine it happening. Because I'm too much of a, I would have been too cowardly to go into that house. I was just like, nope, like, I don't care. But yeah, the tent thing, that wakes me up at night.
Yeah. Nah.
Right then. Most valuable whatever. Can be anything. You start us off, Chris.
Heather? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's sad that people sort of hated that character. There seemed to be a real anti-Heather thing when this film came out and you read the reviews at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't really get it. I mean, yes, she can be annoying at times, but they're all annoying at times, and it's fine to have an annoying character at the centre of your film, and she's going through a lot. So, I just think she sells the shit out of this, so I'm picking your lead actress.
Okay. Gemma?
I think I'll go for Heather as well. People just seem to hate on her, like, whatever, for whatever reason. She's the leader, she's in charge, it's, you know, people have, let's not bring sexism into it or anything like that.
No.
It's the 90s. But yeah, I think she's amazing. That or the really, really, really big stick figure, the furry one that's in the woods. That just, like, I love that. I want that in my house.
Chewbacca, I believe, is what they call that
really?
One on the set.
It's
yeah.
my favourite.
It's interesting you said. Do you wonder if perhaps it's because we see Mike and Josh on camera a lot more than we see Heather. So because Heather is a disembodied voice and we can't read her face as well, and we
That's
can't
so
really understand, like, because you can tell so much about the expression on someone's face. We don't know if she's actually like hiding her fear or she really is like genuinely like that overconfident and whatever. Whereas Mike, you can see his face. He's sullen. He's unhappy. Josh looks scared at points. So maybe that means that Heather is the one who people talk to. Oh, I don't like her.
That's so perceptive. Yeah, that's a really good point. I never even thought about that.
Until that iconic shot where she is right up in with her nostrils in our face.
Yeah, she's completely vulnerable. Yeah.
Which is when everyone feels sympathetic for her.
Yeah.
Jed, most valuable whatever.
Mine is the return on investment. Because this this film made infinity money, and for these like they
spoken like a true producer.
they were all broke. Everyone involved in this film were broke. They were just doing it for favors, and they made a film that stands the test of time as one of the in the top five best return on investments ever for a little found footage movie, and I just think that's incredible. And again, like you heard when I spoke to Eduardo on that podcast, I don't think it's even sunk in even now just how iconic and how incredible that is. And it just gives you lots of hope and lots of like get up and go, like, we can do this. We can do this.
Did the actors get a back end as well?
Yes, I believe contracts were renegotiated after the success of it, which was good.
Well, that is good.
Yeah.
Well, I'll pick our filmmakers, Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. I just think it's a combination of creating this idea that this is real and building such a rich mythology combined with, you know, while I wouldn't like to be an actor working on one of their films, I think this method filmmaking, as they called it, I think you get performances that we wouldn't have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm going for. And finally, what would each of us change about the Blair Witch Project? I'll start with you, Jed.
Oh,
anything. Wow. I mean, because it's one of your favourite films of all time.
It is. It's difficult because, like, I just love every bit of it. Maybe just because you brought up maybe a little bit more of Heather. Mm. Maybe Heather on camera a little bit more. And I was actually, I'm a big fan of The Curse of the Blair Witch, where you have a lot more of that background information. Maybe some of that in the film as well, just so to build a mythology within the standalone film. But it's pretty perfect. It's the best found footage film, one of the best horror movies of all time for me, so it's difficult to find anything to change.
Interesting.
For me.
I'll commit heresy now off the back of that by saying, you actually mentioned it earlier. You said how much you love the start of this film and how much you love the end of this film, and I feel the same. This film starts so well, and like the townsfolk and like building that mythology, and I think the ending, like sort of around the time Josh disappears, and you really feel the anxiety levels rise, and then running around there, Rustin Parr's Jack and then Mike in the corner. I do feel the middle is a bit too baggy. I think there are moments in it which are great, but I do think they're too few and far between, and there's too much repetition of sort of ups and downs, which may be, you know, a realistic portrayal of what it might be like to get lost in the woods. But for me, there are just not enough big hit points that sort of plot developments, character developments, like that keep me interested. And every so often, it does feel like a movie that was winging it slightly in terms of, as they intended to do, sort of like just giving these actors little notes of what they should do that day. And I feel it lacks something. I mean, that's, it's difficult to quite put my finger on it, but you know, you've got Mike kicking the map, which we singled out as a point because that is a big moment. And I think a couple more moments like that might have really helped. Maybe even, this might be the heresy here, maybe even leaning into some more traditional horror scares. Like, for example, you know, instead of just something pressing against the canvas, something slicing open the canvas, something that is a little more of a visceral, holy shit, moment that doesn't necessarily ruin the ambiguity of the film, which I love, but just gives us a little more genuine scares in the middle section, as opposed to sort of just like, this isn't going to end well. Chris?
I'm with you, Jed. I think this is an almost perfect film. I don't think there are many perfect films. No. So I'm going to go with something Eduardo said on your podcast. Well, he said they weren't anticipating it being in the cinemas. They thought they'd made a VHS movie, maybe an HBO movie. And he says they wouldn't have made it quite so shaky if they'd known it was going to be released in a cinema, because they found it hard to watch. Yeah. Now, it was a criticism to level with it. I don't remember feeling it that much when I watched it. It was part of the experience. But if that's what Eduardo's saying, I'm going with that.
Okay. I've come up with another very quick one.
But your last one went on for ages.
I know. I know. It was too long. I should have just read it instead of riffing. Clovenhoof footprints. Could they be deer? Could they be something else leading up to the tent in the middle of the night? Anyway, sorry, Gemma.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think I'm torn about what I changed, because I do think it's the almost perfect movie. I think what I'd like to do is sort of a little bit, I hear what you're saying, Alex, but I think the solution for me personally wouldn't be for more scares necessarily, because I do like that sense that you're with them and you're experiencing like the anticipation of when is it going to happen again, and you're looking, and that's quite exhausting, and you're kind of, it puts you in their empathy and mindset. I like that. I think for me it's more, the solution might be more along something what you were saying, Jed, about I wanted a bit more sense of what is driving their character dynamics and relationships, and like why, like, you know, why does she care so much about this? Like, is it, you know, whether it's like leaning more into, is it just like a protection thing for herself to be filming everything, or is there something else going on? I just wanted a little bit more to like understand why people might be acting the way they are that doesn't have a supernatural explanation. And I think that just tiny, tiny little bits in the middle where you're like, I'm not quite sure why people, you know, would have just tweaked it that, like, you know, 1% more for me. But yeah, otherwise I think it's, I don't know what I'd change. Maybe not the bloody thing they find, like controversially, because that's something really specific, like you're in danger here, whereas everything else is a bit more ambiguous and uncanny, which I preferred. When I saw that bloody thing, I'm like, oh, like someone's pranking you. Like this isn't actually the witch. This is like, did Josh do that? You know, that's what I was thinking.
I think if we made this film back in 99, we would have had at least a couple of levitation scenes, and Heather would be on fire at one point.
That's true. Well, I can't chat really. They're both,
All right, brilliant. Well, by the sounds of things, Paranormal Activity is going to have a tough act to follow on Thursday. But very quickly, let's look ahead to next week. Chris, you've got a clue for our pairing on next week's shows.
Yeah, my clue is both these films are a real drag.
Oh, I know this.
I might not even need to put a second clue up, I think. I think people are going to get it, but...
Yeah. That was one of your easier clues. You're one of your easier clues. Right then, that is it for this episode. A big thank you to our guests Gemma Hurley and Jed Shepherd. Their brilliant found footage horror Dashcam is in cinemas now, so go get some friends together and head to your local cinema for one hell of a ride. Thank you both for coming in. You're coming back on Thursday, yeah?
We are, yeah.
Amazing. Thanks for having us.
Amazing news. All four of us, like I said, will be back on Thursday to discuss Paranormal Activity and decide whether it has what it takes to beat Blair Witch in this week's Clash. In the meantime, please subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Check in with us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. We'll be back Thursday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.